Our commentator will be Stephen Vincent, who is professor of history at North Carolina State. Stephen is well known as an intellectual and cultural historian of French socialism and liberalism. He has written books on the ideas and the milieu of Proudhon, of Benoît Malon, and most recently of Benjamin Constant. All right. Thank you, by the way, for keeping within the time limits. That's great.
Thanks. I've been asked to comment on the papers today, which is a pleasure for many reasons, not least of which is the quality of the papers. I've also known the presenters for a long time, so it's in a sense the continuation of a dialogue that's been going on for a long time. Jeremy and Paul and I were graduate students at the same time, the same institution, so again, sort of continuation. I met Julian, I think, in Berkeley, but then we re-met at all places at a Slavic Studies meeting, a panel. And Suzanne I've met as well, but I think maybe in Madison when I gave a paper a long time ago. But anyway, pleasure. It's slightly a less cheerful task to face bringing these disparate papers together for a coherent comment, however. So I've decided I'm not going to promise any coherence, right? I'm going to make a few limited comments, random thoughts about the general issues that the papers raised. And I hope this will leave some time for the audience to discuss things. Paul's paper raises issues about the usefulness of a comparative analysis of revolutions, especially as it relates to the use of violence and terror. Jeremy's paper looks at the relationship of the French Revolution to recent thinking about European unity, and more specifically, what aspects of the revolution fit or do not fit into a usable conceptualization of a common European past. Julian's paper looks at the importance of references to the French Revolutionary Terror in the thought of Russian populists and terrorists of the late 19th century. Now, when I give lectures on the French Revolution, I generally emphasize, as I suspect most of us do, a couple of obvious things: the importance of natural rights, how they were first articulated abstractly in the universal fashion we think of them today in the Declaration of Rights of Man and Citizen. This document has continued to influence subsequent conventions and charters like the ones that Jeremy mentioned, the 1950 European Convention for the Protection of Human Rights and Fundamental Freedoms, and the 2000 Charter of Fundamental Rights of the European Union. I also emphasize, secondly, as I think probably most of us do, the principle of popular sovereignty, with all of the difficulties encountered in attempting to imagine and to implement a fully formed political system based upon this abstract principle. Representative democracy was, of course, not the only imagined application of this principle. I also emphasize the degree of by which violence was part of the process of instantiating these principles in France and abroad. The violence was limited, of course, until 1792, when the revolutionaries decided to carry their ideals to areas outside the hexagon. The war and the missionary sense of nationalism that is represented led to understandable resistance and reactionary anger on the part of those who faced French armies and French chauvinism, a term that was coined in this period. As Suzanne has nicely highlighted in a recent article in the volume she helped edit, entitled The French Revolution in Global Perspective, there was a shift from and an overlap of cosmopolitanism, an ideal common among Enlightenment philosophers, to universalism, or the presumed universalism, of the revolutionary ideals. Violence was also part of the internal domestic history of the revolution, of course, especially after August 1792. And this is where Jeremy's paper intersects with Paul's and Julian's. Paul suggests that much of the terror in France was state violence to counter and control popular violence, and that this is different from the Cultural Revolution in China, where officials wished to precipitate popular violence. This seems to me a very useful distinction, though I wonder if he means this to be the thin end of a wedge to justify some of the state violence during the terror. If so, then I would probably wish to push back a bit, because it seems clear to me that in both cases, France and China, there was a breakdown of due process or a wholesale avoidance of its consideration. Julian argues that the Russian populists intersected, Russian populism intersected with historical memory of the French Revolution in the thought of 19th century Russian terrorists. This doesn't have much specificity, it seems, beyond a valorization of, in his words, firm, unyielding force, which is to destabilize the regime and trigger a revolution. As he points out, the terror in France was intended to accelerate, not trigger, the revolution, and to stabilize, not destabilize, the regime. So Paul seems interested in finding structural parallels between French and Chinese terror, while Julian is interested in determining how thinking about the terror in the French Revolution echoed in the thinking of Russian terrorists to justify violence. Both remind us how easily the French Revolution became the touchstone for vastly different movements in the 19th and 20th century. One of the issues that might be raised here is what revolution meant to the French revolutionaries, what it meant to Chinese revolutionaries, and what it meant to Russian terrorists. How did it fit into their overall theory of change? One of Martin Malia's points, Paul mentioned him, so the reference isn't totally too wild. One of his main points was that a proper analysis of a revolution must take into consideration what revolutionaries believed they were up to, what they thought their actions meant, why they responded to events in the way they did because of these ideals. In short, what larger intellectual and ideological framework was involved? Where does revolution and terror fit in? How much of a difference does it make that French revolutionaries were attempting to instantiate natural rights and popular sovereignty, while Russian terrorists were deeply influenced by German idealism and Hegelian historical metaphysics, and seemed to assume that just a just society would miraculously emerge from destruction? While communist revolutionaries of the 20th century China were calling for an egalitarian society without markets or private property. These are different goals, even if we recognize that the 1793 Declaration introduced rights to education, health care, and welfare. The goals seem quite different from those of the later Russian and Chinese revolutionaries. Paul has mentioned the forward and backward vision of French and Chinese revolutionaries, but these are structural issues. What I'm suggesting is that the ideological envelope within which revolutionaries moved is probably also important to take into consideration. I think Jeremy's correct when he suggests that many who speak fondly of the French Revolution more recently, unlike leaders of the Cultural Revolution in China or terrorists in late 19th century Russia, wish to separate the revolution from the violence, which was such a basic part of its unfolding. Habermas, as Jeremy reminds us, separated the two. Or to put it more precisely, he bracketed the violence and the divisive aspects of the revolution to give consideration to the positive changes he wished to emphasize. Pierre Rosanvallon, in his recent book on the Society of Equals, makes a similar move, it seems to me. He argues that there was a fundamental revolution in civility and stability, sociability, that undergirded the Atlantic revolutions, namely a belief in the similarity of individuals, the autonomy of individuals, and the community of citizens. His account, however, downplays the divisive aspects of the revolutionary experience, and it pushes aside any analysis of the violence. I don't wish to make violence the essence of the revolution, right, this possession of Ten or Simon Chama. But after the 1,000 killed in August of 1792, the 1,400 killed in the September massacres, the popular violence of the revolution certainly cannot be ignored. And if state violence was to relieve France from this popular brutality, there's a high cost, right? 35 to 50,000 deaths during the terror, which of course leaves aside the 200,000 deaths in the Vendée, the several thousand deaths during the 1793 repressions of the Federalist revolts in Lyon, Bordeaux, and Toulon. I don't have any last words of wisdom, needless to say, on this matter of violence and revolutionary ideals. The debate about the terror, I need hardly point out, will continue. When does authorized legitimate force become unauthorized and illegitimate violence? When does righteous anger against the old order and the passion for the new world become rage, hatred, and vengeance? When does the midwife of liberty become the return of barbarism? Right? It seems naive to suggest that one can change societies as fundamentally as the revolutionaries did without resorting to some violence. On the other hand, impatient revolutionaries are generally not a nice group to confront and often justify violent acts that in retrospect appear excessive. In this regard, occurred to me that George Sorel, who I worked on a long time ago, but he commented on the danger of disappointed optimists. He suggested that when optimists became frustrated, as optimists almost inevitably do, they often become violent. I'm going to read a brief quote from Reflections on Violence. "The optimist may lead his country to the worst disasters. He is not long in finding out that social transformations are not brought about with the ease that he had counted on. He then supposes that this is the fault of his contemporaries, instead of explaining what actually happens by historical necessities. He is then tempted to get rid of people whose obstinacy seems to him to be so dangerous to the happiness of all." As I indicated, these are random thoughts. I thank the presenters for stirring them up.
Do you want to reply, or shall we just open it up for questions? Yeah, let's just open it up for questions.
Do we need to do the whole stand?
I'm Ronan Steinberg from Michigan State University, for the record. There you go. So I have many things to say, but I will not say.
You only have 12 minutes.
Yeah. No, I'll keep it short. I actually did find, or I think I could find, a common line, certainly between Julian and Paul's paper. I'm working still on how to put Jeremy's paper into the framework, but anyway, and that is about the different attitudes, or maybe common attitudes to time and temporality that terrorism invokes. Julian, you spoke about Claudia Verhoeven, and one of her main arguments is that Karakazov, who failed in his assassination, is the first modern terrorist because he tries to accelerate historical change, right? For her, that's what modern subjects do. And that's kind of something she sees in the carrying on in the concept of modern terrorism. And so when I heard Paul's paper talking about China, I thought, I see similar things in China, but not in the Cultural Revolution, a little bit before, in the Great Leap Forward, right, the attempt to accelerate time. And actually, if you carry that forth to the Soviet Union, in Stalin's programs, right, like NEP and whatever, those programs of moving things forward, you see that kind of attempt to accelerate time. Actually, Robespierre, in the two speeches that he speaks about virtue, begins by talking about the break from the past. I assume the other one is the December speech on the revolutionary government. It speaks about how we cannot use the past as our book. We have to start kind of tabula rasa. It's a kind of the rupture, right, the myth of temporality. So the attitudes to time seem to me to be an interesting connection here. The one question that I had to Paul is, you created this discussion, the affinity, I don't know, comparison between Mao and Robespierre. I'm thinking about, after Nine Thermidor, of course, Robespierre was vilified. Mao Zedong is a more complicated story after he dies, right? I think there was a common agreement that emerged under Deng Xiaoping to say that Mao did, what is it, 70% right, 30% wrong, right, about Mao Zedong's legacy. And there was an accounting after Mao's death, but the blame was put on his wife, right? She was put on trial, part of the Gang of Four, right? Think about Suzanne, right? Blame the women for the violence, kind of like October Days, right? In the Cultural Revolution too. So there's vilification of Robespierre. Mao is not exactly vilified, right? For I don't know how to say. That's a kind of a different and interesting thing. I'll stop here. I have many other things to say.
That's absolutely true. It's a more complicated matter for the revolutionaries to deal with Mao and his legacy, because they don't want to repudiate him entirely, but they do want to compartmentalize the discussion of what had happened and to put it on his shoulders and on Zhang Qing's, certainly, as well. She does, she and the Gang of Four get a lot of the blame. But it was, you know, she would not have been in a position to exercise that influence if she had not had the imprimatur of Mao himself. So he is scarcely blameless. And this is an issue that I think is actually still being wrestled with among the Chinese political leadership today. But it is striking that, you know, if you travel around Paris today or France, you find very few legacies of Robespierre's role in their history. Statues, streets named, that's, you know, it's just not there. Mao's picture is still on the mantelpiece of, you know, a great many households in rural China today. So he is still viewed as the kind of semi-deity that he became during the Cultural Revolution, largely under the propaganda generated by Lin Biao and the PLA. So, yeah, that is a difference between the two.
I think there's one metro station, by the way, named after Robespierre.
Yeah.
But definitely it's in Montreuil.
Right, sure. Right.
I think it's line 9.
And I'll just follow up very briefly to make a somewhat obvious point that brings Russia and China together further, which is the notion that Verhoeven talks about Russia in the 19th century as being out of time. And what that means is out of the time of Western modernization. Mm. And so it's not a coincidence that the tremendous violence in Russia and in China in the 20th century is related to fundamentally peasant societies that are experiencing top-down, state-run, enforced modernization. So and then we start to draw the contrast that the factions of the 1790s are in no way parallel to the party system that emerges through, you know, Marxism-Leninism, with implications in Russia and obviously in China in the 20th century. So well, both on modernization and the party.
That last point might be a disputed one. The Jacobins are often seen as the first.
I think it's anachronistic in terms of a party to adherence. You know, we even see the notion of a cell in my period that I'm looking at, and the formation of a founding of a party with almost a military type of hierarchical organization seems different than the fluid types of factions. You know, Tallien is Robespierre's friend before he stabs him in the back. I mean, there's a fluidity throughout the 1790s that is different than, I think, a 20th century party structure.
Well, surely that is also a characteristic of the Russian revolutionary parties. They're constantly splitting and turning against each other. Ask any Menshevik.
Okay, other questions? Yeah, Katie.
Hi, I'm Katie Jarvis. I'm from the University of Notre Dame. And thank you all for your papers. They're really interesting and innovative. And my question's for Paul. So I wanted you to reflect a little for us on the role of the youth in China versus the role of the youth in France. I'm specifically thinking of the Gilded Youth and how it's interesting that the youth moment there is after the terror in some sense. And if you had thought about the similarities and differences in that aspect.
I'm beginning to, and I'm not quite there yet. Because the Red Guards obviously are young, and it's not only the role that the Red Guards play in the revolutionary violence of 1966 and 67, but it is also significant that many of them, millions of them, at the end of the 60s and on through the better part of the decade of the 70s, were sent out into the countryside to work among the peasants, to take their own expertise out there, but also to learn from the peasants and to learn about that life. Yang Guobin talks about this as an experience that led them to sort of shed their revolutionary idealism and come in contact with real life, and come to realize that what the revolution had claimed to have been establishing for Chinese society had scarcely been achieved out there in the countryside. So there's nothing quite like that going on in the Terror. I mean, it's also very striking to me as I think about these two periods that the leadership in China during the Cultural Revolution were all old. They had survived not just a few years of revolution, but decades of revolution. One of the chief, you know, tasks for the Committee of Public Safety is to lead France through this war with Europe that they were in the midst of. Few of them had experience of war or the battlefield. The Chinese leadership had all been through, you know, the civil war with the Kuomintang and the war with the Japanese as well in a very real way. So that experience, I think, affected their thinking about politics and the political struggle within the party and in some sense against the party. So I'm not quite sure where I'm going to go with that, but it's something that is, I think, crucial to the project and sort of sorting out. Mm-hmm. But so that's about all I can say right now, Katie. Thanks.
I'm Adrian O'Connor from the University of South Florida. Thank you all for really great papers. I'd like to return, if I may, to the, forgetting exactly who brought it up, but Bob Darnton's line about possibilism in 1989. And it strikes me that's often, it's often received by my students as a sort of version of the American dream, right? You can be anything you want. But it strikes me it's a much more anxious line, right? Possibilism against the givenness of things, that essentially the future will be radically unlike the present and the known past. And it strikes me that that notion of both optimistic and deeply anxious possibilism may play into to where Paul and Julian, where you see this legacy of the revolution, and perhaps, Jeremy, to your paper, some of the discomfort of the revolution in the European Union's project. I mean, the deep anxiety behind so much integration is World War I and World War II, right? It isn't so much what is possible, it's look at what has been possible. Right. And while that's true or truer in the Chinese case, I think there is still, with to Ronan's point, with the Great Leap Forward, there is this modernization language behind much of even the destruction of the Chinese Revolution. And certainly, with I was thinking of Georges Sorel as well, and this sort of creative destruction. What is the creative side of the EU? Right. I mean, other than look, let's not have World War II, and let's not have the Holocaust, and let's not have the Cold War. I mean, there's far less of a projected possibilism built into that, and far
that
more
obviously
of a preventive.
Is the great failure of the EU. The founding generation of its founders, you know, for them, the reference of the two world wars was very real, something they had personally experienced and something they were determined to keep from occurring again. And the current population of Europe doesn't have that same feeling that no matter what else, you know, the European project has to be kept alive because it is safeguarding the continent from war. As historians with the long view, I think we're probably better positioned than other people to understand that it doesn't take much to move from a situation of peace to a situation of conflict. And the unit I did in this course I created last spring on the breakup of Yugoslavia was a vivid reminder of that. Mm.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think we're actually out of time. Thank you for terrific, really thought-provoking papers and comments.
You know, your paper reminded me that there are...